you know, I guess on the from the outside looking in, everything was rosy and according to society's conventions of what success looks like, you know, I had the six-figure salary, I had the business class flights, you know, the sharp suit and all that good stuff. But I guess deep down, I found myself miserably comfortable.
Where do we start this? And the answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Sell or Die podcast, the global premier personal development and sales podcast on the planet. My name is Jeffrey Gittimer, author of The Little Red Book of Selling and my newest book, The Sales Manifesto.
And I'm Jen Gluckow, author of Sales in a New York Minute. We are interviewing leaders in business, sales, and personal development to give you the strategies it takes to make more sales and make more money.
Strategies that you can take out into the street and turn into money 1 minute after you hear them.
In a manifesto moment?
Well, no, more like in a New York Minute.
Oh, thank you to all the diehards out there supporting us with listens and five-star reviews.
Be a star on Sell or Die. Leave your own review. Come on. Go to your computer right now. Go to iTunes right now and write down, type down, talk down exactly how you feel about this podcast and how it might affect others.
All right. I want you to enjoy today's show. Take notes and tell us what you think on our Sell or Die Hard official Facebook group.
All right, let's get to it. It's time to sell or die. Steve Glavesky is an entrepreneur, an author, and podcast host whose mission is to unlock the latent potential of organizations. He's the co-founder and CEO of Collective Campus, an innovation accelerator based in Melbourne and Singapore. Steve is the author of Employee to Entrepreneur, How to Earn Your Freedom and Do Work That Matters. Please help us welcome diehards, the great Steve Glavesky.
Welcome, Steve.
Hey, guys. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We're glad you're here.
So tell our diehards right now, what's the time in Australia?
Well, now it's about 8 past 6 a.m. in Australia, which, you know, probably sounds really early, but I'm usually rolling out of bed at 5 a.m. to hit the gym anyway, so I am ready to rock and roll. I pumped out literally 100 push-ups just before I got onto this show, so I'm good to go.
That's it?
Wow.
Only 100?
I did four.
in a row. I did four in a row.
Damn.
I struggled, but I did them.
I have to do, like, you know, in yoga when you do the chaturanga thing and it's like a push-up, and there's like 10 of those in a 45-minute class. Oh, man, my arms hurt the next day.
Oh, my God. What a wuss.
Right.
Or the Pilates classes where they get you to kind of do a side lunge and just sit there and hold it for like a minute.
I know.
Just burning like crazy.
Yeah, but it hurts more the next day.
Before we get into the first question, how does your exercise affect your mental acuity during the day?
Oh, it's absolutely massive, Jeffrey. I mean, I've been working out now since, you know, I'm 35 now. I've been training about 5-6 days a week since I was about 21, 22. And I think in terms of mental focus, I find that on days when I don't work out, particularly if I've gone more than one day without working out, which isn't very often, I am just nowhere near as focused. It also, I find, gives me a lot of mental clarity because oftentimes, you know, we've got that chatter going on in our minds. And one way to silence that chatter is just to work out, even if it's for 20 or 30 minutes, even if it's a brisk walk. It helps to, you know, clear those cobwebs away so you can actually focus on getting work done.
Yeah, we agree totally.
100%.
The challenge is that most people don't wake up with a clear mind and have trouble clearing the cobwebs out because of the beer that's in between their ears from the night before.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
All right, Steve, your book is called Employee to Entrepreneur, How to Earn Your Freedom and Do Work That Matters. Did you go from employee to entrepreneur?
Oh, yes, I did, Jen. I spent a good decade in the corporate world as a management consultant. And that was working for the likes of, you know, Ernst & Young, KPMG, Macquarie Bank, which is one of Australia's largest investment banks. And, you know, I guess on the from the outside looking in, everything was rosy and according to society's conventions of what success looks like, you know, I had the six-figure salary, I had the business class flights, you know, the sharp suit and all that good stuff. But I guess deep down, I found myself miserably comfortable because I was essentially doing work that wasn't aligned with my natural strengths, my inclinations, what my essential mission or purpose was in life. And I just found myself, you know, on the way home from work every night, whether it was riding the subway or in an Uber, just questioning what did I actually contribute to the world? And it oftentimes was difficult to answer that question. And I think it was Steve Jobs who was quoted in saying, if you wake up too many days in a row and look in the mirror and find yourself saying, I don't want to do what I'm going to do today or something to that effect, then it's time to change course.
I think that your quote of miserably comfortable was freaking brilliant.
Yeah. I think we both just wrote that down.
Yeah, I wrote it down.
I did too.
I think that you're in a position where if you wake up many days and you're miserably comfortable, say that three times, you need to self-assess what it is that you're really trying to accomplish, what it is that you're really trying to achieve, because another day at work is probably not going to achieve it.
Well, you said after you said miserably comfortable, you said it was because you were not aligned with your strengths. So how did mm-hmm. you figure out what your strengths were and how to align to them?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jen. And I think more broadly speaking, I mean, a lot of people, I find, perhaps don't invest the time to figure out what those strengths are and also what they actually enjoy. You know, we come out of high school, you know, we sit in a career counselor's office when we're 17 years old and they basically ask us, hey, kiddo, what do you want to do with your life? And essentially, we haven't got the requisite life experience at the age of 17 to really know what the hell we want to do with our lives. But we rattle off something based on what they, you know, push us towards, and it might be accounting or law or something conventional. And so we go off and we study accounting, say, for 3 or 4 years, and then we join an accounting firm and we become institutionalized. And eventually, like I said, we find ourselves miserably comfortable. And I think one thing Robert Greene also talks about in his book, The Laws of Human Nature, is spending your 20s as if it was an apprenticeship in a way. So trying lots of different things. So I found that by immersing myself in different things, you know, learning about lots of different topics, reading lots of different books, trying lots of different things, whether it was in the work context or outside the work context, you know, that gave me an appreciation for what I am good at. But again, it's not something that, you know, you can just sit down, do an IQ test and, you know, here's what you should do with the rest of your life or with the next 5 years. I think the more you try, the more you figure out what you're good at and also what you enjoy. And also, more importantly, perhaps what you don't enjoy, because nobody wants to spend their whole life doing something they don't enjoy. And then, like Jeffrey said, they wind up drinking nothing but beer all night because they're just trying to quiet their mind and get away from the reality of their day to day.
So exactly. You had this job where you were miserably
comfortable
mm-hmm. and you left.
Yeah. Yeah, so. I did. And it's, it wasn't a question people often ask me is, when should I leave? How do I know if it's the right time? And, you know, my story wasn't really following the typical side hustle book, if you will. I mean, I was still employed on a full-time basis for an investment bank, which meant, you know, spending, you know, quite a few hours of the day on my day job. But at the same time, I had observed that there was a lot of vacant office space everywhere I went, particularly in my life as a consultant. And I thought, well, you know, Airbnb is taking off. Why not have a flexible office sharing market, essentially a marketplace for office space, meeting rooms and things to that effect. So, you know, rather than do what many first-time entrepreneurs do, which is spend $50,000 on an app development agency, buy some agency who's going to tell you that they love your idea, they want to be aligned with it. So rather than charge you $100,000, they're going to charge you $50,000. And off they go. They build it. And ultimately, you get excited, and then you spend another 10 or 20 grand on a marketing. And of course, you haven't done any customer testing. So it's crickets. So rather than do that, I essentially spent nothing more than $2,000 building a low fidelity prototype. And I figured, you know, I built that prototype using nothing more than an Airbnb script and a web developer I had found on freelancer.com. So it was really, really low fidelity, nothing special, but it did the core thing. You know, you could search for space, you could book space, you could see the calendar, you could list photos, all that good stuff. But what point is a prototype if nobody knows about it? So being as naive as I was at the time, I Googled how to write a press release and tried writing one.
You know, I'll tell you, if there's a lot of authors out there that want to know how to write a book proposal, just Google it.
Well, that's how Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx, got into her thing. She Googled like how to create a patent. And she patented her whole thing.
Yeah, but this is the thing, guys. I mean, a lot of people don't Google things.
I know, it pisses me off.
it's nuts. And then they'll come along and you no doubt receive a lot of questions yourselves, and people will ask you something that if they just spent 5 seconds, not even, Googling it, they'd find hundreds of answers. In fact, they'd find lots of poignant answers, but they just don't bother doing that. They'd rather speak to 100 people. And I think that speaks to people's tendency to want to delay actually taking action, actually doing the work. It's a lot easier to just talk to people about things than it is to Google it and just start working at it.
Keep Googling.
So
keep,
how did
going
you
on
get
with your story.
Your product known, your prototype known?
Yeah, so after I wrote the press release, I essentially went onto Twitter and I just searched for journalists, tech journalists. And what I found was all these journalists had their email address in their profile. Nowadays, if I was to do that, I'd use tools like Rocket Reach or Hunter, where you can find people's email address much quicker. But this was back in 2012, so that tool didn't exist. So
way back. I don't know how you can go back that far. Go ahead.
Exactly. And I sent the press release to about 100 journalists, and how many do you actually think got back to me, guys?
Seven.
I think Jen said one, so ding, 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 we have a winner.
Oh, my God.
But we had one person get back to us, but it just so happened to be a journalist from The Australian, which is essentially, I guess you could say, our equivalent of... maybe the New York Times is overselling it, but it's got a circulation of close to 1 million across the country.
Wow.
And yeah, within 2 weeks, you know, they published this article, and it was funny because they wanted a photo. And so they insisted on taking a photo of me during my lunch break, literally just around the corner from my office, in front of this iconic fountain in Sydney's Martin Place. So while I was surrounded by this film crew, I had several colleagues walk by, you know, spot me, think, what the hell is going on here? But long story short, you know, the article ran, that got the interest of early stage investors. And within 3 months, I managed to raise about $150,000, which wasn't a lot, but it was enough for me to say, okay, let's give this entrepreneurship thing a full-time crack, as we like to say here in Australia, for the next 12 months. And, you know, 7.5 years later, and I haven't looked back.
Wow. Yeah, that's a way to go. It seems as though from entrepreneur from employee to entrepreneur, do you have your other expression in there of miserably comfortable?
In terms of my other expression, sorry?
Have you trademarked it? Have you made a book title out of it?
Jeffrey's still obsessed
Where's
with
your
it, so we're going
video
back 10
of
minutes.
It? Yeah, it's amazing.
I mean, it is in the book, that expression. Maybe
no, we have millions of people in this country that are miserably comfortable.
Yeah, we do.
We do. Do they know they're miserably comfortable, or do they just think that's the way it is and that work is just something you don't enjoy?
This is my statement when you said you have a lot of people come up to you and ask you, when's the good time to leave? I think if they're asking you that question, it's time.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, it's time. The question is, how do you go about leaving? So I've talked through one particular method you can explore. I mean, the second one is one thing I did... Even after that, when I started Collective Campus, you know, people like to talk about side hustles. I like to talk about something called a reverse side hustle for employees who go to entrepreneurship. So what is a reverse side hustle? Well, if you have spent, say, a decade, maybe even less, in the corporate world, you've got a degree, you've got that experience. Mm-hmm. Chances are you can pick up a reasonably well-paying contractor gig where you might get a healthy hourly rate and you could potentially make enough to get by for 2 days a week. So I picked up that kind of a gig when I was building Collective Campus. For the first 6 months, I worked 2 days a week for KPMG, and they paid something like $700 a day, which is a good $1,400 a week, which is more than enough to get by. But the beauty of doing that, instead of having like a traditional side hustle where you work all day, 5 days a week, you get home at like 6 or 7 p.m. And then with whatever cognitive, you know, scraps you have left.
Not a lot.
If any, you invest in the business. This way, you know, a couple of days contracting or part-time work, then you give yourself 3 full days to work on your business. And that way you're giving yourself the best of yourself into the business, and you're going to get much further, much faster doing that than, you know, working 8 p.m. every night for 4 or 5 nights a week.
Brilliant. I think it's brilliant. And I think that people who are listening, diehards, if you're listening, not all of our diehards are happily gainfully employed. Many of them are either searching or pissed off where they are. I'm against side hustles. I don't think that they bear the fruit that you're looking for. I think that if your side hustle isn't your full hustle, then something's wrong. But we have the benefit of Steve here today, who's talking to us about how to deal with your side hustle in a way that actually makes money. And it's like a passive side hustle, but it's enough to be able to get by so you can quit your job and do what you really love.
Exactly. And I mean, one of the things people might struggle with is that they may have several ideas and they're not sure which one they want to explore. And that's where they may fall into the trap of analysis paralysis. And I mean, what they can do nowadays, it's not as if you really need to set up all these different businesses and invest tens of thousands of dollars in each one. You know, you can just set up, I mean, determine firstly, what are the customer segments you're targeting, what's the problem you're solving, and what is the solution you're proposing? And then go out and just create, you know, hundreds of ads potentially, where you specifically target that customer segment. The ad copy in these ads talks to the problem you're solving, and then just look at the data. Where are people responding the most? And that will give you an indication as to where you should potentially spend your time so that you get closer to something resembling product market fit or results, rather than, you know, spending the next year, 2 or 3 of your life doing something that perhaps there's just no real market for.
Or asking your friends every day if they think you're on the right track or doing the right thing.
You can ask your parents, right? But if they think you've got a great idea, I find a lot of 30-somethings do that. Okay, my mom thinks it's a good idea.
So let me throw this at you, and I think this is really an important part for our diehards who are listening right now. Mm-hmm. Steve went to technology to affirm the fact that he could pull off what he wanted to pull off. He didn't go to investors first. He went to technology first. Technology gave him the answers that allowed him to go to investors, and that's what catapulted him to his level where he is today. He stuck at it and he worked at it. And I think that you can affirm that, but did we miss anything in the middle?
So I used technology. One other thing I used initially was I published an ad on a website called the Australian Institute for Company Directors. This was just before the prototype as well. And the ad supposedly, I mean, it suggested that I was looking for a non-executive director. I wasn't. I was looking for feedback. But on the back of that ad, which was free, I got about 30 meetings with seasoned startup founders who had built and sold businesses, as well as executives who worked in commercial real estate because Hot Desk was in that space. Wow. And on the back of those 30 meetings, I mean, they basically asked me a hell of a lot of questions that I hadn't even thought about. So with each subsequent meeting, my understanding of the business model got better and better, so that by the time I actually got talking to investors, I was ready for all of their questions. And you raise a very valid point as well, Jeffrey, which is too many of today's early stage entrepreneurs conflate raising capital with market validation for their ideas, which is just not true. If you're an investor, you're going to place a lot of bets, you're going to have a diversified approach, and you're going to hope that maybe one out of 10 in your portfolio actually bears fruit and covers all of the losses. And if you're raising early, before you even have revenue, then if you're successful doing that, you may raise at a low valuation, give away a lot of your business, raise from unsophisticated investors, and potentially fall into lots of traps that term sheets can present, such as, say, liquidation preferences, where your investor may get 2 or 3x in the dollar for every dollar you exit at. And you might find yourself working for several years and have very little to show for it. So always focus on building a business that makes money before you actually start thinking about raising that capital.
Jeffrey, what's that in your coffee cup?
What do you think it is, Jen? It's Death Wish coffee. It's the only coffee I drink. Death Wish is the world's strongest coffee, and the world's strongest salesperson needs the world's strongest coffee.
Jeffrey and I drink it, and diehards, you need to be drinking it too. It'll help you wake up and smell the order forms. They have 100% no bullshit money back guarantee, so go get your first bag or first box of K-Cups of the world's strongest coffee at deathwishcoffee.com.
So what does an order form smell like?
So Steve, you make this transition from employee to entrepreneur sound super simple and super easy, even when talking about the fact that you got publicity early on from one of those journals. It was like, well, we sent it out to 100 and we got one back, but we got the right one back, you know? And so, you know, what were some of the struggles that you faced, and how did you overcome them?
Yeah. And great point, because it's definitely not easy. And when I tell that story, like, I'm not discounting the fact that, hey, there was an amount of luck that took place or that played a part. And I think with anything, though, luck is just a byproduct of doing the work. You're not going to get lucky unless you actually, you know, put everything on black, for example. But there's a hell of a lot of challenges, particularly in the first year or two, because I think coming out of the corporate world where, like I said, you know, I was doing quite well. And I think if you were to look at what society deemed successful, I was successful. But then when you make that jump, when you go from a six-figure salary to perhaps paying yourself $500 a week, as I was initially, because I wanted to
when you want
extend
to
my runway as long as possible. Yeah. When you start, and when you want to compare yourself to, or when you do compare yourself inevitably as a human being to your friends and your former colleagues in the corporate world, and you look at them and they're all getting promoted and moving on to even bigger salaries, and you're barely making ends meet and you're struggling to get to revenue with your business, that can lead you to a somewhat dark place. I like to call it the abyss. It's like in the movie Wall Street, where Bud Fox's colleague, as Bud's getting arrested, says, "Man stares into the abyss, sees nothing staring back at him." At that point, man finds his character. And I think that's the same as entrepreneurship. Like, I think during that first year, like, there was a hell of a lot of times and I was like, oh man, is this, am I wasting my time? Am I giving up, you know, all my education and all that time I spent in the corporate world? Am I going to even be able to go back if this doesn't work? And I think you learn to develop a healthy relationship with that adversity if you want to become successful as an entrepreneur. Otherwise, you're just going to give up. And one thing I talk about nowadays is, in order to develop a healthy relationship with adversity so you can push through all the inevitable setbacks and rejections and people not returning your call, is to just engineer it into your life. You know, one thing I like to do is to just make sure I get uncomfortable as often as possible. So, you know, last year I did 5 open mic stand-up comedy gigs. And, you know, that was like, what, I have no issues getting up in front of hundreds of people, say, doing a keynote speech at a conference on entrepreneurship. But put me in front of 10 people in a smoky back alley bar somewhere where my job is literally just to make them laugh for, say, 4 minutes. That is a totally different proposition.
Oh, yeah.
But by, doing stuff like that.
And they'll give you feedback immediately.
They will give you immediate feedback. And oftentimes it's not the kind of feedback that makes you feel all that good. But nonetheless, it's something I like to do, whether it's that, whether it's learning a new skill, whether it's taking up something like surfing or rock climbing or whatever it is. Doesn't need to be physical. It could just be having a cold shower once a week in the dead of winter. And I find doing that sort of stuff just means that you get better with dealing with that discomfort. But the more it shows up, the more you can actually get those quick wins on the board, those runs on the board, the easier it becomes. And then after a while, you find yourself rarely, if ever, staring down into that abyss.
What did you learn from those stand-up comedy efforts?
What did I learn from the stand-up comedy? I learned something. It just reiterated my belief in the value of short feedback loops. I think nowadays, the difference between, say, your smaller business nowadays and your big behemoth is the fact that a smaller business moves a lot faster because they're not, you know, embroiled in policy and process and regulation and whatnot. And as a result, even though they have a lot less resources, they can get a lot further by virtue of learning faster. And the beauty of stand-up comedy is it teaches you a number of things. One thing is we're wrong about most of our ideas most of the time. So if I'm standing in front of the mirror rehearsing my 5-minute set for the night, and to me it sounds amazing. It's like, oh, this is gonna kill tonight. And of course, it doesn't. You get up there, you start, and it's just silence after the first joke. Then the mind starts to chatter, and you think, oh crap, this is gonna be a long 5 minutes. And it teaches you that you're wrong about most of your ideas most of the time, but by getting back up the next night, you can tweak things as quickly as possible. And by the end of the week, it's like, oh, actually, these jokes are now getting a laugh. But if you only show up once a year, then you're going to have to wait a good year to get closer to something resembling, you know, product market fit, if we were to take the stand-up comedy example and apply it to business. And that's why startups have an edge over big behemoths, because they can move quickly, they can learn quickly, and when you can learn quickly, you can get to a positive outcome much faster.
One more thing for our diehards out there. Did you happen to film yourself while you were doing this stand-up comedy?
I've got one gig that I can that I did film, and it is online. I can share that if need be.
Yeah, please put that into the show notes, because here's the deal. I will guarantee you our diehards are total chicken shits about going to comedy night, open mic night, and giving their 5 minutes.
Yep. Let alone doing it for a week.
Huh?
Yeah. Let alone doing it for a week.
Well, hats off to you. I was like, I secretly have my 5 minutes. They're ready to go.
Jeffrey, maybe you need to push yourself outside your comfort zone more.
Yeah.
I think that's what Steve's saying.
That's it. You got to do it, Jeffrey. I'm sure there's plenty of open mic nights in Charlotte. Most of the stuff, like I went out to the Comedy Store when I was on my book tour earlier this year in LA, and I saw Joe Rogan, Theo Von, and a number of other people. And these guys, most of them had specials. Most of them were just testing material, and they were bombing like crazy, but they didn't care because it was just part of their craft. And that's just the nature of entrepreneurship too. When you're first starting, hey, you're going to bomb. You're going to have a lot of rejections. You're going to hear no a lot, but you need to be comfortable with that. You need to keep picking yourself up and moving forward. As Rocky said in Rocky One, you know, it's not about how hard you get hit. It's about how you get hit and keep moving forward.
So diehards, let me just challenge you with this. Here's a guy from 15,000 miles away who decided to take his side hustle, make it his full time goal and aim, and figured out a way to do it, quit his job, and made it happen because he stuck at it. And I think that's a real important part of this life.
I think some of the things you're really talking about here are stepping out of your comfort zone, practicing for hours and hours and hours and hours, way many more hours than you think were ever needed, and then being resilient when you don't get the answer or the response that you were hoping for.
Right. You stick at it just like a sale would be. You don't take the first no.
Yeah.
You don't take the fifth no.
Yeah. It sounds exactly like entrepreneurship and exactly like the selling process, actually.
I guess it's about what's your relationship with no look like? And it's not just a no, but why is it a no? And I know this is something that you guys talk about when it comes to sales, but no is just an objection. But how do you turn that no into a condition? What does a no actually say? Because you can learn with every no. I mean, it was the same with my book, Employee to Entrepreneur. Going into that with this mindset of having a reasonably healthy relationship with no, I knew that I was going to get rejected from agents, from publishers, many a time before I actually got to a deal. But with every rejection, I didn't just leave it at that. I actually went back to them and said, okay, well, why is this a rejection? And I gave them a number of different points that they could simply highlight, such as doesn't align with our publishing material. We think that the market's saturated for this type of thing. We don't think your platform's big enough, whatever it was. That would give me an indication as to where the no was coming from so that I could update the book proposal with every subsequent pitch.
Yeah.
And it was literally 39 rejections before I got the callback from Wiley, one of the world's biggest business publishers, who said, hey, we're interested in your book proposal. Can we tee up a conversation? And then several conversations later, I had the book deal. But that's essentially how I expected that to go. But if you go into it with that mindset of, oh, this book deal is going to crush, and the first agent or publisher who sees it is going to give me a deal, and then you don't, you're probably going to give up before you get to that yes.
So wait, you only had 39 no's? Yeah, what the hell is that about?
I'm curious, did you have like a 99 threshold from your first experience with those journals?
Pretty much. I think that's what it was. So if the first experience with those journalists, if I got it on the first email, maybe I would have given up with the book deal. But it's funny because Ben Mezrich, who wrote Accidental Billionaires, which was turned into the movie The Social Network, and he wrote Bringing Down the House, which was turned into the movie 21. I had him on my podcast recently, and he was saying that when he first got a book deal for Accidental Billionaires, he had over 100 rejections. I think it was 160 rejections before he got that book deal. And it went on to become, you know, sold millions of copies, New York Times bestseller, turned into a movie, all that good stuff. So I think the more you learn that successful people go through these things, the more you expect it yourself. So you're not surprised when you hear no.
I think that you have to look at it from the perspective of how many can you take? And, you know, when we just went to Outbound and we did this thing in Atlanta with Jeb Blunt and his troop of people, he had 52 turndowns from one guy who wouldn't talk to him, wouldn't deal with him. And finally, on the 53rd try, he made the sale.
Yep.
But he wasn't willing to give up. He knew in his heart that he could help this guy. And he kept on going for it. The same way you know in your heart that your book deal is right or that your business venture is right, you go for it until you achieve it.
Of course, of course. And I mean, you can always increase the likelihood of getting to a yes by looking at signals in the market in terms of, does it look like this particular organization or this person is actually ready to buy? I mean, are they talking about, say, for example, if I'm selling a particular type of technology, are they talking about this tech on social media? Are tools like BuzzSumo or Signals indicating that certain organizations are interested in a particular topic? You know, we've got all sorts of alerts set up nowadays for things, given that Collective Campus is in the space of, say, innovation, digital transformation, agile, lean startup, all that sort of stuff. We have alerts set up so that anytime an organization is in the news talking about transformation, innovation, whatever the case is, we'll have an email that goes out to the particular person that's mentioned in that article. So then that likelihood of getting a yes is somewhat higher.
Of course.
So, I mean, we only have so many hours in a day. So if I'm going to spend all my time following up on someone, I want to be following up on someone who's perhaps more likely to convert than someone who just doesn't have, you know, the budget, the authority, timing need, and so on that they need to buy. And then I could be as relentless as possible, but I could potentially still end up nowhere.
So I would only challenge our diehards that here's a person who's giving you information that you can turn into your own money. And I would challenge you to go out and buy his book and then read his book. I would also challenge you to listen to this episode two or three times so you can pick up those tips that you feel you need for your career right now.
Totally. Steve, before you go, can you tell us about the lemonade stand?
Of course. I would love to tell you about the lemonade stand, Jen. Lemonade stand is a children's entrepreneurship program we developed about 3 years ago. And essentially, it started as a two-day business school for kids, we called it, for 9 to 12-year-olds. And again, it was a case of experimentation. We know that, you know, 40 to 60% of today's jobs won't exist in 10 to 15 years because of automation. But we know that kids are still learning the same old stuff in school. And oftentimes they're being taught in a way whereby they're just seeing school work as schoolwork and not necessarily something that can help them in the future. And it was funny because our experiment in this case was literally a Eventbrite event. So literally took like an hour to put together a simple event page. What we did then was asked ourselves the question, well, where is our audience hanging out and who is our audience? Our audience we thought was 35 to 45 year old moms, young moms with maybe young kids. And where are they hanging out? Well, at the time, many of them were on, say, subscribing to Facebook mom blogger pages. So we will target those pages. Mm-hmm. And we spent about several hundred dollars to essentially get ourselves 20 converted clients. So 20 converts at about $500 a pop. So we spent several hundred dollars and made about $10,000 on the test run. Now, what was funny about that was we had very little experience working with kids at the time, and it went as bad as you can imagine. In terms of, we had a 9-year-old throwing chairs around the room, another kid banging his head against the wall. It was absolute bedlam. And at the end of the day, I sat down with my co-founder and was like, I don't know if we keep doing this, but we learned from that. And we spoke to some people who work with kids in children's education programs. We learned about all the things we needed to take care of next time, all the checklists we needed to have in place. And we implemented that stuff. And since then, we've rolled the program out to 1,000 kids. We've had no more such issues. It's been rolled out in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and Singapore. And just recently, we turned it into, we partnered with a school here in Melbourne to turn it into an online interactive platform where kids can collaborate with each other from across the world, build prototypes, test their ideas, pitch their ideas, and also raise capital via the platform. So even if they want to raise, say, $500 from people around the world to further build their ideas, they can do that. So that's something we'll be taking to the market next month in August, which I'm really excited about. And ultimately, at its core, it's about teaching kids, not necessarily just to be entrepreneurs, but to teach them the underlying attributes of an entrepreneur, which is, you know, adaptability, resilience, and also
attitude. Knowing.
Yeah, exactly. And that your ideas aren't always right. And, you know, like Richard Feynman said, we can only be sure we're wrong. We can never be sure we're right. And that's the essence of the scientific method. And I think teaching kids that early so that they don't go into life with this morally righteous attitude and think they're right all the time, I think can only be a good thing.
If you would like an American affiliate with several hundred thousand people on a mailing list, we are definitely interested.
Yeah, I'd be totally interested.
I would love to have that conversation.
Okay, cool. Stay on this call after this episode
is over. I had to ask, I don't know how many of our diehards might be interested in that, but I was genuinely curious because I saw that you were doing entrepreneurship work with kids, and mm-hmm. it just looked like a lot of fun because, you know, kids should learn about that kind of stuff and they're not being taught it in schools.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And, you know, I've been, like I said, working as an entrepreneur now for almost 8 years. And it's funny because one of the most memorable days that I can point to in my time as an entrepreneur was when I got an email from one of the Lemonade Stand graduates about 3 months after he went through the program. This was an 11-year-old. And he emailed me and said, "Hi, Steve, just wanted to let you know my website, my business is now live. Here's the link. I'm basically selling inflatable water sports gear." And he basically went on to say that, you know, before I did the Lemonade Stand program, I didn't even realize that this was something that kids my age could do. So I just wanted to say thank you for opening my eyes to the opportunities. And he went on to make about $1,000 a month in his first few months.
As an 11-year-old? I love
as
it.
11-year-old, right?
He's paying his parents' expenses.
No, what he should do is give his parents a $20 bill at the end of the day and say,
"Here's your allowance.
Wake me up at 8.
Exactly. I didn't get out of bed for less than $100 is what it should be saying.
Wow, that is phenomenal. Steve, thank you so much for coming on our show and sharing your expertise. We'll make sure to link to your book and your website in our show notes.
And I must say, you don't only sound intelligent, you are intelligent.
Yeah.
No, thank you so much, Jeffrey, and thank you so much, Jen. This has been an absolute pleasure. I've done a hell of a lot of podcasts this year, and this has definitely been one of the most fun podcasts I've had. Thank you so much.
Top 100. We'll take that. We'll totally take that. Cheers.
Cheers.
Another fantastic episode of Sell or Die is now in the books.
Let's let the listener be the judge of that.
You can be. Subscribe. Rate and review our show today. In fact, right now.
Or if that sounds too complicated, tell a friend.
Tell both your friends.
Because if you're not selling,
you're dying.
We're leaving.
Au revoir.
Shalom. We'll be right back.
This has been a presentation of the Sell or Die Network. For more podcasts that you can take out into the street and turn into money, visit sellordienetwork.com.